and rapid transit companies in Manhattan, and one proposing a general state tax on all such power and traction privileges in order to replenish the state treasury. It was to the last bill, a measure of Senator John Ford's then languishing in committee, that Roosevelt seemed to be referring. Although his remark was casual, the committee chairman took the hint and within 3 days sent the bill to the House with a favorable report. Roosevelt, delighted, began to push for its passage at once. Here was a measure designed to siphon off some of the money flowing through the politico-corporate machine and return it to the community in the form of increased values for property owners and, possibly, reduced taxes. The organization might be persuaded to agree. Platt himself had suggested that a tax reform committee be appointed to send some proposals to the next legislature. But Roosevelt saw no reason to wait until 1900. Hurrying to New York on 24 March, he invited the easy boss to breakfast with him at his pied-à-terre on Madison Avenue next morning. "I was hardly prepared for the storm of protest and anger which my proposal aroused," Roosevelt wrote afterward. Platt considered the Ford bill dangerous in the extreme. In its sweeping generalities and radical ideas, it was a shot into the heart of the business community and an extreme concession to Bryanism. If Roosevelt wished to push such a measure through, the organization would block it. The whole question of tax reform, Platt explained, was too complicated to rush. He repeated his suggestion that a joint legislative committee investigate at leisure and report in the session of 1900. If Roosevelt agreed to this, Platt promised that some serious effort would be made to tax franchises. The governor capitulated, with real or feigned humility, and on 27 March sent a message to the legislature recommending that Platt's committee be appointed. He took the opportunity to complain that farmers, market gardeners, tradesmen, and smallholders were bearing a disproportionate burden of taxation in New York State, while franchise-holding syndicates kept every dollar of their profits. "A corporation which derives its power from the state," he declared, "should pay the state a just percentage of its earnings as a return for the privileges it enjoys." Then, in a conclusion which struck many commentators as weakly deferential to Platt, he left it to the proposed committee to decide just how franchises should be taxed, and who should do the taxing. Since the Ford bill had specific suggestions on both these points, it was assumed that Roosevelt had given up on the measure. Actually, he liked it more and more, although he had one reservation. It empowered local county boards to make assessments rather than the state. This obnoxious clause, which played directly into the hands of Tammany Hall, was sufficient to prevent him speaking out publicly in the bill's favor. But he hinted to various reporters that he would not be sorry to see it pass anyway. On 7 April, he risked another Platt explosion by telling the editor of The Sun, "I shall sign the bill if it comes to me, gladly." On 12 April, he was surprised to hear that the Senate had mysteriously passed the Ford bill by a vote of 33-11. Whatever Platt's motive in letting Republican members vote for it, perhaps he was making a gesture to placate tax reformers while still intending to block the measure in the Assembly, Roosevelt now had an excuse to take a public stand. On 14 April, he announced that the bill, however imperfect, was beneficial to the community. The Assembly should send it on to him at once for signing. To Platt, he guilelessly explained that he had broken silence simply at the request of the Senate Majority Leader, who felt the reputation of the Republican Party was at stake. Platt's response was to employ dilatory tactics. The House Taxation Committee promptly pigeonholed the bill, and nothing more was heard of it. Meanwhile, a rival measure appeared on the floor and was subject to lengthy debate, obviously for purposes of delay. The end of the session, scheduled for 28 April, was fast approaching, and Roosevelt grew impatient. After 4 months in office, he felt sure enough of his strength to challenge Platt directly. He made up his mind that if I could get a show in the legislature, the bill would pass, because the people had become interested and the representatives would scarcely dare to vote the wrong way. Accordingly, he set to work on individual assemblymen, a task in which he had acquired expertise during his own terms as minority leader, and used his tame press corps to take daily polls of the increase of likely votes in the House. By noon on 27 April, there was a reported majority of 12 in favor of the Ford bill. All that remained now was to persuade Platt's leaders to bring it out of committee. As governor, Roosevelt possessed one formidable weapon which he had hitherto refrained from using: the special emergency message. Under the rules of the legislature, he could use such a ploy to take up any bill out of turn and force it onto the floor. At 5 o'clock, therefore, when pressure in behalf of the Ford bill had built up to a maximum in the Assembly, Roosevelt dictated his message demanding its immediate passage. Speaker S. Fred Nixon, who had received direct orders from Platt not to pass, simply tore the message up without reading it to the House. He then retired to an anteroom and suffered a nervous collapse. Roosevelt heard the news at 7 o'clock next morning, the final day of the session. He reacted much as he had when the Mausers were heard at Las Guasimas. Whether he advanced or retreated now, his political life was in danger. Nixon's rejection of his message, if allowed to go unchallenged, would mean fatal humiliation at the critical moment of his governorship. What was left of his strength would waste away through the non-legislative months of 1899. When the session of 1900 opened, he would be a dead duck, with little hope of renomination by a contemptuous Senator Platt. Meanwhile, lobbyists for the big franchise holders in New York City were warning him that if he sent another message, he would under no circumstances ever again be nominated for any public office, as no corporation would subscribe to any future Roosevelt campaign. Stepping through the barbed wire, the governor fired off another, more peremptory message. "I learned that the emergency message which I sent last evening to the Assembly on behalf of the franchise tax bill has not been read. I therefore send hereby another message upon the subject. I need not impress upon the Assembly the need of passing this bill at once. It has been passed by an overwhelming vote through the Senate. It establishes the principle that hereafter corporations holding franchises from the public shall pay their just share of the public burden. It is one of the most important measures, I am tempted to say the most important measure, that has been before the legislature this year. I cannot too strongly urge its immediate passage." This time, he entrusted his personal secretary, William J. Youngs, with delivery, and sent an added threat that if the message were not promptly read, he would come over and read it himself. Platt's lieutenant surrendered at once. The Ford franchise bill was passed by a landslide vote of 109-35, and the legislature adjourned. Looking back over the session in the first flush of his victory, Roosevelt felt some relief and no little pride in what he had accomplished as governor. There had been, beside this recent spectacular achievement, a good deal of progressive legislation, which made up in historical significance what it lacked in contemporary drama. "I got an excellent civil service law passed," he boasted by way of example. This was true enough. The original law, which he and Grover Cleveland had engineered in 1883, had been repealed in 1897, for no other reason, apparently, than to increase Republican spoilsmanship. Cooperating with his old friends at the Civil Service Reform Association, Roosevelt had succeeded in getting a stiff new bill through the legislature, but only after Herculean labor and some spontaneous assistance from Senator Platt. The resultant act was the most advanced for any state in the nation. Roosevelt also congratulated himself, justifiably, on his labor record. He had supported, fought for, and signed several bills aimed at improving the working conditions in tenement sweatshops, at strengthening state factory inspection procedures, at limiting the maximum hours to be worked by employed women and children, and at imposing a stricter 8-hour day law upon the state workforce as an example to other large corporations. He consulted widely with union officials, far more than any of his predecessors, and greatly strengthened the state supervisory board to protect industrial workers from exploitation. Fortunately, there had been no violent demonstrations to strain his good humor. Yet. There had been one or two blots on Roosevelt's record, which time would darken, notably his decision in late February to send a woman to the electric chair for the first time in the history of New York State. This was in spite of the anguished pleas of humanitarians and warnings that the execution would destroy his presidential chances. The governor justified his decision by saying that the woman had been fairly convicted of murder, and that in any case, sex had nothing to do with the law. Roosevelt's only major inherited problem, the Erie Canal scandal, was for the time being dormant, thanks to his appointment of Superintendent Partridge and courageous selection of two Democrats to reinvestigate. Critics might complain that the delay was unnecessary, given last year's proof of Republican malfeasance, but few observers doubted that the governor would prosecute fearlessly if the evidence was upheld. Altogether, I am pretty well satisfied with what I have accomplished, wrote Roosevelt. I do not misunderstand in the least what it means, or rather, how little it may mean. New York politics are kaleidoscopic, and 18 months hence, I may be so much out of kilter with the machine that there may be no possibility of my renomination. Along with parochial, the adjective kaleidoscopic was increasingly a part of his vocabulary, as he contemplated the rapid shifts of fortune which had marked his recent career. The kaleidoscope continued to shift, ever more rapidly, in the days and months ahead, disclosing sometimes a dazzling perspective to infinity, sometimes dark visions of chaos. Thus, within a month of his boast to Lodge, he was confessing to Bammy that he felt a wee bit depressed, a Rooseveltian euphemism for submersion in the slough of despond. Having had time to reflect, he realized that his early reservations about the Ford franchise tax bill, now lying on his desk for signature, had been well-founded. The local assessment clause was indeed an alarming problem. In New York City, for instance, it meant that Tammany Hall would have the power to tax all the traction companies or demand vast bribes for leniency. No wonder his oldest corporate friends, including Chauncey Depew, were incensed at his stand. In addition, the stock market was down, the New York Times accusing him of opportunism, and worst of all, Senator Platt had hurled the organization's ultimate obscenity at him, albeit in a gentlemanly letter dated 6 May, 1899.
When the subject of your nomination was under consideration, there was one matter that gave me real anxiety, the senator wrote. I had heard from a good many sources that you were a little loose on the relations of capital and labor, on trusts and combinations, and indeed on those numerous questions which have recently arisen in politics affecting the security of earnings and the right of a man to run his own business in his own way, with due respect, of course, to the Ten Commandments and the Penal Code. Now came the imprecation. I understood from a number of businessmen, and among them many of your own personal friends, that you entertained various altruistic ideas, all very well in their way, but which before they could be put into law needed very profound consideration.
Roosevelt knew that in Platt's vocabulary, altruistic meant socialistic or worse.
You have just adjourned a legislature which created a good opinion throughout the state, the easy boss went on loftily. I congratulate you heartily upon this fact, because I sincerely believe, as everybody else does, that this good impression exists very largely as a result of your personal influence in the legislative chambers. But at the last moment, and to my very great surprise, you did a thing which has caused the business community of New York to wonder how far the notions of populism, as laid down in Kansas and Nebraska, have taken hold upon the Republican Party of the state of New York.
The letter began to ramble, and concluded with an almost fatherly appeal to the young governor's discretion.
I sincerely believe you will make the mistake of your life if you allow the bill to become a law, wrote Platt, advising him, with a political experience that runs back nearly half a century, not to sign the bill.
Roosevelt deliberated for 24 hours before dictating a reply. He wryly thanked the senator for the frankness, courtesy, and delicacy of his letter, not to mention his cooperation during the legislative season.
I am particularly sorry that the most serious cause of disagreement should come in this way right at the end of the session.
With tongue firmly in cheek, he assured Platt that he was not what you term altruistic to any improper degree. As regards the Ford bill, pray do not believe that I have gone off half-cocked in this matter. Then he launched into a classic statement of his political philosophy.
I appreciate all you say about what Bryanism means, and I also am as strongly opposed to populism in every stage as the greatest representative of corrupt wealth. But these representatives have themselves been responsible for a portion of the conditions against which Bryanism is an ignorant and sometimes wicked revolt. I do not believe it is wise or safe for us as a party to take refuge in mere negation and to say that there are no evils to be corrected. It seems to me that our attitude should be one of correcting the evils, and thereby showing that whereas the populists, socialists, and others really do not correct the evils at all, the Republicans hold the just balance and set our faces as resolutely against improper corporate influence on the one hand as against demagogy and mob rule on the other.
In hopes of achieving a just balance with Senator Platt, the governor now made a dramatic offer. He was willing to reconvene the legislature for a special session in the hope that the Ford bill's obnoxious assessment clause might be amended. It must be clear to both houses, however, that the essential principle of taxing franchise privileges must stand. Organization and corporate lawyers welcomed the idea of an amended bill. They obviously intended to shoot it so full of holes that it would hang limp in any breeze of reform. But Roosevelt had a final ultimatum to make to Platt before sending out his summons to the legislators.
"Of course it must be understood that I will sign the present bill if the amended bill fails to pass."
The easy boss remained silent, and on 22 May, the assemblymen and senators were back at their desks in the Capitol. Leaving nothing to chance, the governor delivered copies of his ultimatum to the leader of the Senate and to Chairman Odell, and recruited two of the finest legal consultants in New York State to scrutinize every semicolon that came out of either house. He even arranged for delaying tactics in the event of a recall move, so that he could sign the Ford bill into law before the page boys reached his office. So short, indeed, was the distance between his pen and the document lying open before him that Platt's leaders gave up the attempt to write a new bill more favorable to corporations. All they could do was to insert various strengthening clauses into the original bill, exactly as Roosevelt had intended. No amendment was made without his approval, and the revised measure cleared both houses in 3 days. The governor proudly and accurately described it as the most important law passed in recent times by any state legislature. He signed it with a flourish on 27 May and sat back to enjoy the sweetness of his victory. Whether he tasted the fruits to the full is doubtful. For all the praise that poured in from the anti-organization press, Governor Roosevelt, declared the Herald, has given the finest exhibition of civic courage witnessed in this state in many a day. He only knew that he was tired to his bones. "I have had 4 years of exceedingly hard work without a break, save by changing from one kind of work to another. This summer I shall hope to lie off as much as possible." But pressure of speaking engagements up and down the Hudson Valley kept him away from Oyster Bay until the middle of June. Even then he had only a week at home before setting off west to attend the first Rough Riders reunion in Las Vegas, New Mexico. The 2-day celebration, which I would not miss for anything in the world, was timed to begin on the first anniversary of the Battle of Las Guasimas. As he journeyed west, he pondered again the relations of capital and labor, trusts and combinations. Platt might think him loose on these subjects, but they preoccupied him more and more as he contemplated America's entry into the 20th century. The Ford bill had been but a step, admittedly a pioneering one, toward resolving the giant inequities of the capitalist system. Some future chief executive more powerful and visionary than William McKinley must bring about similar legislation on a national scale. The thought of McKinley made Roosevelt slightly uneasy at present. Ever since taking the oath at Albany, he had been receiving demands from the pesky Mrs. Bellamy Storer that he campaign for the promotion to cardinal of her favorite archbishop, John Ireland of St. Paul, Minnesota. She imagined that as governor of New York State, he could prevail upon the president to prevail upon the pope. But Roosevelt was aware of various stately squabbles within the church and knew that Ireland was persona non grata at the Vatican. He had therefore hedged repeatedly, pleading lack of knowledge, lack of influence, and lack of propriety. But Mrs. Storer would not be put off, and he at last wrote the president a less than enthusiastic plea on her behalf. McKinley's reply, which had arrived a few days before his departure for the West, was a polite refusal to intervene in the affairs of another state. Behind the politeness lurked a hostility that probably went back to the Round Robin incident at the end of the war. The final installment of the Rough Riders, containing Roosevelt's own account of the affair, along with many hints of administration mismanagement, was currently on the newsstands. Roosevelt had long since given up hope of being awarded the Medal of Honor. No War Department board was going to recommend his controversial name to the president. But the fact remained that McKinley would probably win a second term in 1900. The election was only 18 months off. And Roosevelt, if he wished to emerge as a possibility in 1904, must at all costs preserve amiable relations with the White House. On the same day he received McKinley's rejection of his Storer appeal, he had written querulously to Secretary of State John Hay, "I do not suppose the president ever goes to the seaside. It is not necessary to say how I should enjoy having him at Oyster Bay, if possible. But as the governor proceeded west and southwest through Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas, he realized that he must offer McKinley something more than sea air as an assurance of loyalty. For the embarrassing fact was that huge crowds were waiting to greet him at every station, exactly as if I had been a presidential candidate. He found William Allen White was already working for his nomination in Kansas. What the two men said on this subject during a brief mid-journey meeting is unknown, but White was at least persuaded to avoid setting Roosevelt up as McKinley's rival in 1900. There is no man in America today whose personality is rooted deeper in the hearts of the people than Theodore Roosevelt, the little editor wrote, as soon as his friend's train was over the horizon. He is more than a presidential possibility in 1904. He is a presidential probability. He is the coming American of the 20th century. Eastern newspapers mockingly reprinted this and other Roosevelt for President editorials and suggested that McKinley had better look to his skirts at next year's convention. After 36 raucous hours at Las Vegas, Roosevelt hurried back to New York on 29 June and announced that he was definitely not a presidential candidate. He urged all Americans to vote for the renomination of William McKinley. With that, he adjourned to Oyster Bay, only to be greeted by a garrulous speaker eulogizing him as the man in whose hands we hope the destinies of our country will be placed. At this, his gubernatorial dignity began to collapse. He struggled like a small boy to keep his face straight, but grins broke through, and as the crowd burst into applause, he laughed till he shook. "Now as to what you say about the vice presidency," Roosevelt wrote to Henry Cabot Lodge on 1 July. Lodge's first words on this interesting subject are unfortunately lost, but it is clear from their surviving correspondence that he considered a vice presidential nomination in 1900 to be the best assurance of a presidential nomination in 1904. McKinley's last running mate, Garrett A. Hobart, was a nice old boy, but in failing health. Rumor had it he would not seek a second term. The president might prefer to select another nice old boy, like John D. Long. On the other hand, the National Convention might prefer Roosevelt, in which case McKinley would undoubtedly bow to its wishes. As Joe Cannon of Illinois once remarked, "McKinley has his ears so close to the ground, it's always full of grasshoppers." "Curiously enough," Roosevelt went on in his letter to Lodge, "Edith is against your view, and I am inclined to be for it." There were at least two alternative avenues of approach to the White House. One was to continue his admirable career as governor of New York and run for re-election in 1900. Unfortunately, that would only carry him through the year 1902. By 1904, the people who were shouting for him now might well have forgotten about him. "I have never known a hurrah endure for 5 years." Another choice would be to succeed Russell A. Alger as Secretary of War. It was an open secret that McKinley wanted to get rid of that embarrassing executive. Roosevelt earnestly wanted the secretaryship. "How I would like to have a hand in remodeling our army." But McKinley had seen enough of his behavior in the Navy Department to look for somebody less forceful. All in all, therefore, the vice presidency was his best chance of keeping in the national spotlight until 1904. At least it was an honorable position. But Roosevelt wrote sadly, "I confess I should like a position with more work in it." There could hardly be an executive position with less. Tiredness, intensified by his week of railroading, returned as he finished his letter to Lodge. Word went out that the governor intended a month's rest. Reporters, photographers, and glory seekers were asked to stay away from Sagamore Hill. "I don't mean to do one single thing during that month," said Roosevelt to his sister Corrine, "except write a life of Oliver Cromwell." Roosevelt's 13th book and third biography, which one friend of the family described as a fine imaginative study of Cromwell's qualifications for the governorship of New York, was completed by 2 August. Even allowing for the fact that it was dictated and that the author spent another month or so revising the manuscript, its speed of composition must be considered something of a record. What was more, Roosevelt did not have the month entirely to himself as he had planned. McKinley summoned him to the White House for a consultation on the Philippines on 8 July, and he spent 3 days later in the month at Manhattan Beach trying to restore good relations with Senator Platt. Yet somehow he found time to produce 63,000 words of English history, remarkable for clarity and grasp of detail, if not for style. According to his stenographer, William Loeb, the governor would appear in his study every morning with a pad of notes and a reference book or two, and proceed to talk with hardly a pause, pouring out dates and place names as copiously as any college professor. The British military attaché, Colonel Arthur Lee, who was Roosevelt's house guest at this time, remembered him calling in another stenographer and dictating gubernatorial correspondence in between paragraphs of Cromwell, while a barber tried simultaneously to shave him. Yet there was no lack of continuity as the author's mind switched to and fro. Robert Bridges came out on 12 August to look at the draft typescript and remembered one chapter that could have been printed as it stood, with mere mechanical proofreading corrections. Roosevelt, who shared the ability to double dictate with Napoleon, did not think his intellect was in any way remarkable. "I have only a second-rate brain," he said emphatically to Owen Wister, "but I think I have a capacity for action." When Wister repeated this remark to Lord Bryce many years later, the great scholar was unimpressed. "He didn't do justice to himself there, you know. He had a brain that could always go straight to the pith of any matter. That is a mental power of the first rank." Oliver Cromwell, however, has dated even less well than Thomas Hart Benton and Gouverneur Morris. Unlike those earlier books, it contained no original research. Nor was it short of competitors in the field. Even in 1899, it could not compare with the standard lives of the Protector. Reviews were few and apathetic, and the book quickly faded from memory. Yet, as a clear, rapid analysis of one leader of men by another, it still has its merits. As with the two previous biographies, Cromwell is most interesting when it draws parallels between author and subject. Roosevelt's own analysis of it remains the best and most succinct. "I have tried to tell the narrative in its bearings upon the later movements for political and religious freedom in England in 1688 and in America in 1776 and 1860. Have endeavored to show how the movement had two sides, one medieval and one modern, and how it failed just so far as the former was dominant, but yet laid the foundations for all subsequent movements. I have tried to show Cromwell not only as one of the great generals of all time, but as a great statesman who on the whole did a marvelous work, and who, where he failed, failed because he lacked the power of self-repression possessed by Washington and Lincoln. The more I have studied Cromwell, the more I have grown to admire him, and yet the more I have felt that his making himself a dictator was unnecessary, and destroyed the possibility of making the effects of that particular revolution permanent." Not surprisingly, Roosevelt's flying visit to the Capitol prompted instant speculation that McKinley, gratified by his recent announcement of support, intended to name him Secretary of War after all. The secretaryship was indeed discussed at the White House that night, at such length as to lend credence to the rumors, but Roosevelt, showing remarkable self-control, assumed that if the President wanted his advice on War Department management of the Philippine situation, he should regard me as wholly disinterested. He therefore announced, as soon as he stepped into McKinley's office, that I was not a candidate for the position of Secretary of War and could not leave the governorship of New York now. This protestation seems to have increased McKinley's respect for Roosevelt as a man, if not as an ambitious politician. On 31 July, Secretary Alger stepped down, and the President named Elihu Root to succeed him. Then Vice President Hobart, though ailing, let it be known that he would like to remain in office indefinitely, so another of Roosevelt's avenues for advancement closed off. The governor, setting off for a fall tour of state county fairs, decided to let the kaleidoscope shift for itself for a while. In the new year, once the legislative season was fairly underway, he would gaze through the prisms again and see if any new perspectives had opened up. For the first time in his adult life, he felt no desire to hurry. He was, after all, nearly 41, with a growing family. Alice was almost as tall as he was now, a decent income, and a job that he loved. "I do not believe," he told Lodge, "that any other man has ever had as good a time as governor of New York." Here, within certain geographical and political limits, was the supreme power he had always craved, and the events of last April had shown how well that power became him. Senator Platt, fortunately, had recovered from the Ford franchise tax bill and was disposed to be cordial. This augured well for their working partnership through the next session. Roosevelt would live out the 19th century in Albany. 1900 was not, as so many of his constituents seemed to think, the first year of the 20th, and try to persuade Platt that he was worth renominating for a second term. I should be quite willing to barter the certainty of it for all the possibilities of the future. Niagara Falls, Silver Lake, Chautauqua, Watertown, Riverhead, Otsego City, Mineola. In fair after fair, all through September, Roosevelt waved, spoke, pumped hands, tasted prize-winning pumpkin pies, and basked in the admiration of the public. Whenever he emerged from his train, whenever he walked past an apple tree full of children, he was greeted with shrieks of, "Hello, Teddy, you're all right," or "Three cheers for the next president." He had a stock response to the latter. "No, no, none of that. Dewey's not here." This invariably brought laughter and applause. The hero of Manila Bay, now steaming homeward in glory, had indeed emerged as a dark horse candidate, despite his own protest. "I would rather be an admiral 10 times over. Few professional politicians, Roosevelt included, took the phenomenon seriously. The Olympia was scheduled to enter New York Harbor on 28 September and cruise up the Hudson next morning to a welcoming thunder of more ammunition that had been expended to destroy the Spanish fleet. On Saturday, 30 September, Admiral Dewey, President McKinley, Senator Hanna, and 35,000 marchers would proceed down Fifth Avenue to 23rd Street, where a 70-foot triumphal arch, modeled after that of Titus in Rome, gleamed white as a symbol of America's entry into world power. It was to be the greatest parade since the Civil War, and Roosevelt, as governor of the Empire State, would ride at its head in top hat and tails. "I am sorry, for I happen to have a particularly nice riding suit with boots, spurs, etc.," he grumbled to Adjutant General Andrews. But when the great day came, he cut an unusually impressive figure in black and gray. Seated on an enormous charger, with his tall hat flashing, he dwarfed the guests of honor rolling behind him in carriages. A small boy named Thomas Beer happened to be standing in Grand Army Plaza as the parade came around the corner of 59th Street and began its descent of the avenue. When Beer wrote the concluding pages of The Mauve Decade a quarter of a century later, Roosevelt wrote in his impressionistic memory as a figure of strength and promise, great yet uncorrupted by the disease of greatness, looming head and shoulders above the fin de siècle pageantry all around him. A bright dust of confetti, endless snakes of tinted paper began to float from hotels that watched the street. Why, you could see everything from here. Brass of parading bandsmen and columns wheeled, turning at the Red House to the south. Balconies and windows showered down confetti, and roses were blown. The very generous dropped bottles of champagne. The little admiral was a blue and gold blot in a carriage. The president and the plump senator from Ohio and all these great were tiny images of black and flesh in the buff shells of carriages in a whirling rain of paper ribbons, flowers, and flakes of the incessant confetti blown everlastingly, twinkling from the high blue of the sky. How they roared! "Theodore Roosevelt!" The increasing yell came from up the street. A dark horse showed and slowly paced until it turned where now the gilded general stares down the silly city. A blue streamer, infinitely descending from above, curled all around his coat, and he shook it from the hat that he kept lifting. Theodore Roosevelt! The figure on its charger passed, and a roar went plunging before him, while the band's shocked ears and drunken soldiers struggled out of line, and these dead great, remembered with a grin, went filing by. And then, on 21 November 1899, Vice President Hobart died. Chapter 28. The Man of Destiny. Round and round the house they go, weaving slow, magic circles to encumber, and imprison in their ring Olaf the King, as he helpless lies in slumber. The passing of Garrett Augustus Hobart had several immediate political effects. One was to strengthen Henry Cabot Lodge's strange conviction that Roosevelt should run with McKinley in 1900, in the hope of succeeding him in 1904. He was adamant. "I have thought it over a great deal, and I am sure I am right." Most people, including Roosevelt, were puzzled by this attitude. Henry Adams interpreted it cynically. "You may well believe," he wrote Mrs. Cameron, "that Teddy's presidential aspirations are not altogether to Cabot's taste, and that the chapter now opening there may have its dark adjectives." Roosevelt's own reaction, now that he was firmly back in office at Albany, was that the vice presidency was about the last thing for which I would care. When Lodge first mentioned the idea, it had admittedly seemed attractive. He loved Washington, loved the largeness of its politics in contrast to Albany's parochial affairs. At that time, too, Platt had been meditating revenge over his sponsorship of the Ford franchise tax bill, and Roosevelt had begun to feel insecure as governor. But things seemed to be changing for the better. On 11 December 1899, Roosevelt wrote Lodge, "Platt told me definitely that of course he was for me for renomination, that everybody was." But everybody was not. Even as Platt made his assurances to Roosevelt, representatives of the franchise corporations were urging that the governor be forced out of Albany and onto the national ticket. They had heard rumors that Roosevelt was plotting further altruistic legislation to do with the limitation of trusts and the preservation of the state's natural resources. Clearly, if the man were permitted to serve another term, he would destroy the economy of New York State. Senator Platt became sympathetic to these arguments when he saw the proofs of Roosevelt's annual message for 1900. Here was provocative language about the need for increasing a more rigorous control of public utility companies that had acquired wealth by means which are utterly inconsistent with the highest laws of morality. The state should be given power to inspect and examine thoroughly all the workings of great corporations, where necessary, publishing its findings in the newspapers. Here, too, were suggestions that New York's defective lumbering laws should be changed so as to prohibit the dumping of wood dyes, sawdust, and other industrial products in any amount whatsoever into Adirondack streams. There were pleas for the protection of birds, especially songbirds, and eccentric remarks like, "A live deer in the woods will attract to the neighborhood 10 times the money that could be obtained for the deer's dead carcass." In addition, Roosevelt recommended that the liability of management for labor accidents should be increased, and he had harsh things to say about Republican corruption in last year's canal steal. The message was, in short, alarmingly radical to a man of Platt's conservative temperament. Even so, he would be inclined to tolerate it, in the knowledge that his lieutenants in the legislature would not, were Roosevelt not also contemplating the dismissal of Superintendent of Insurance Lewis F. Payne. This official, an aging, rat-toothed defender of corrupt businessmen, had once been described by Elihu Root as a stench in the nostrils of the people of the state of New York. The governor was entitled to plenty of animosity toward him since Payne, a black supporter, had been responsible for the publication of his embarrassing tax affidavit during the campaign of 1898. There had been little opportunity for revenge during 1899, for Payne's 3-year term appointment was not due to expire until January 1900. But Roosevelt had been marshaling evidence against him for months. He found that the superintendent had intimate and secret money-making relations with New York's biggest insurance companies. Moreover, in the matter of appointments, Payne represented the straightest sect of the old-time spoils politician. While the evidence was not enough to warrant criminal prosecution, it at least justified the governor's decision to displace him. The problem was that the big insurance companies wished Payne reappointed. So, in consequence, did Senator Platt, and so did a majority of the Senate. This practically guaranteed Payne tenure, because until the Senate confirmed Roosevelt's choice of a successor, the superintendent would remain in office under the state constitution. Roosevelt tried to mollify the easy boss by suggesting Francis J. Hendricks as a replacement. Hendricks was the very man Platt had ordered him to appoint as superintendent of public works back in the fall of 1898. The senator, as was his wont, listened impassively and said nothing. But when Roosevelt offered the job directly, Hendricks declined for business reasons. The inference was he had been told not to accept. Payne, meanwhile, declared his determination to stay at a press conference on 12 December. "No one has ever charged that I have not performed my duty successfully," he exclaimed in aggrieved tones. During the next couple of weeks, the relative positions of governor and boss hardened on the issue. "Platt does not want me to fight Payne, and feels pretty bitterly about it," Roosevelt told Lodge on 29 December. More ominously, Platt had stopped making promises to protect him from the vice presidency. He now merely quoted other people's opinions that it would not be a wise move, personally. Then, as Albany filled up for the New Year's opening of the legislature, Roosevelt heard that Platt was telling intimates, that I would undoubtedly have to accept the vice presidency, that events were shaping themselves so that this was inevitable. Roosevelt's second annual message was greeted by most Republican newspapers as statesmanlike in its attitude to trusts, thanks to judicious modification of the original text by Elihu Root. Strangely, the conservation section, with revolutionary pleas for a system of forestry gradually developed and conducted along scientific principles, passed largely unnoticed. Here, the governor was reflecting the views of another expert advisor, Gifford Pinchot, chief forester of the United States. Tall, lithe, dreamy-eyed, irresistibly attractive to women, the 34-year-old Pinchot had for years been Roosevelt's main source of ecological information. His theory that controlled conservative lumbering of state and national forests would improve not only the economy, but the forests themselves, was enthusiastically propounded in the gubernatorial message. Roosevelt also hinted that a bill to scrap the present 5-man forest, fish, and game board and replace it with a single progressive commissioner would be forthcoming early in the session. The governor disclaimed any personal responsibility for the measure, but its opponents, headed by Senator Platt, were quick to note that it had been prepared by the Boone and Crockett Club and that both Pinchot and the proposed commissioner, W. Austin Wadsworth, were members of that Rooseveltian organization. Within a few days of his message, Roosevelt received word that Judge Charles T. Saxton, another independent organization man of the best type, was willing to accept the post of superintendent of insurance, providing Senator Platt and Charles O. Dell could be persuaded to forsake Payne. Roosevelt was optimistic. "While I did not intend to make an ugly fight unless they forced me to it, yet if they do force me, the fight shall be had." Unexpected ammunition fell into his hands on 11 January 1900, when a stockholder of the State Trust Company of New York, one of Payne's strongest backers, came to Albany with evidence calculated to embarrass the superintendent and liquidate the company. According to the stockholder's figures, Payne had received $435,000 in loans based on various unsaleable industrial securities of uncertain and doubtful value, together with what purports to be a certified bank check for $100,000. He petitioned for an immediate investigation of State Trust's books by the superintendent of banking, Frederick D. Kilburn. Roosevelt, showing his usual disregard for niceties of protocol in an emergency, ignored Kilburn and ordered Adjutant General Andrews to conduct the investigation within 24 hours. "I had to act at once," he explained to a doubtful Supreme Court justice. The unspoken implication was that Kilburn, a holdover from the Black administration, might be rather less willing than Andrews to involve the superintendent of insurance in a major scandal. Andrews had his report ready the next day, 13 January. Although it betrayed signs of hasty and superficial analysis, there was enough evidence of Laocoon-like entanglements between the directors of State Trust and Lewis F. Payne for Roosevelt to proceed well-armed to a bloody breakfast with Senator Platt. "When I go to war," the governor confided to a friend, "I try to arrange it so that all the shooting is not on one side." The breakfast, which was also attended by Chairman O'Dell, parchment, pale, glowering, and watchful, secretly ambitious to supplant Platt as boss of the party, took place on Saturday, 20 January. It proved to be less of a war than a series of brief preparatory skirmishes. Roosevelt insisted that Payne must be replaced. Platt insisted that Payne would stay. The governor was sure that Judge Saxton would be an acceptable substitute. The boss was equally sure he would not. Retreating slightly, Roosevelt produced his usual list of names, most of whom are straight organization Republicans, who would administer the office in a perfectly clean and businesslike manner. Platt waved the list aside with loathing, but allowed O'Dell to pocket it. Then Roosevelt delivered his ultimatum. The organization had until Tuesday, 23 January, to approve one of the names. If no word was received by then, he would pick his own candidate and send the nomination in as soon as the legislature opened for business on Wednesday morning. Thanks to the Payne scandal, he felt quite confident there would be enough votes in the Senate to ratify his choice. Platt's response was to make a public announcement shortly afterward that he believed Roosevelt ought to take the vice presidency both for national and state reasons. Judge Saxton gracefully withdrew his conditional acceptance of the nomination and suggested the governor again approach Francis J. Hendricks. Roosevelt did so, but he had yet to receive a reply when he encountered Platt on the afternoon of the 23rd. The senator still refused to consider any other superintendent of insurance but Payne, and threatened war to the knife if Roosevelt tried to oust him. With only hours to go before his self-imposed deadline expired, the governor threw caution to the winds. He politely informed Platt that he would send in Hendricks's name in the morning without fail, a massive bluff considering that Hendricks had not yet given him formal permission to do so. A little later in the day, Odell asked for a final pre-war conference with the governor. Roosevelt said he could be found at the Union League Club that evening. If he hoped that Odell would arrive with conciliatory messages, he was soon disillusioned. Platt, he was told, would under no circumstances yield. If Roosevelt insisted on opposing him, his reputation would be destroyed, and there would be a lamentable smash-up from which he would never recover politically. At this, the governor got up to go, saying there was nothing to be gained from further talk. Odell, impassive and inscrutable. You have made up your mind? Roosevelt.
I have.
Odell. You know it means your ruin. Roosevelt, walking to the door.
Well, we will see about that.
Odell. You understand the fight will begin tomorrow and will be carried on to the bitter end. Roosevelt.
Yes.
At the door.
Good night.
Odell, as door opens.
Hold on.
We accept.
Send in Hendricks.
The senator will make no further opposition. Recollecting this dialogue in his autobiography, Roosevelt commented, I never saw a bluff carried more resolutely to the final limit. It is not certain whether by this he meant Odell's or his own. The following day, Wednesday, Hendricks telephoned acceptance, and on Friday afternoon, Roosevelt joyfully released news of the nomination to the press. Privately, to his old assembly colleague Henry L. Sprague, he wrote,
I have always been fond of the West African proverb, speak softly and carry a big stick, you will go far.
In this case, the big stick took him as far as the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia. Although the proceedings there did not open until 19 June 1900, Theodore Roosevelt's trajectory toward the vice presidential nomination began to accelerate from the moment the New York State Senate confirmed Hendricks as superintendent of insurance on 31 January. The very next morning, a mysteriously planted article appeared in the Sun saying that representatives of the Republican National Committee had visited Roosevelt in Albany and urged him to consider acceptance of the nomination. Another mysterious article in the same paper, datelined from Washington, reported that many of the most influential Republicans in the Capitol, including probably a majority of senators and representatives, believed him to be the logical candidate of the party for vice president. It was not difficult for Roosevelt to guess which persons might have provided the Sun with this information.
I need not speak of the confidence I have in you and Lodge, the governor wrote plaintively to Platt that morning. Yet I can't help feeling more and more that the vice presidency is not an office in which I could do anything.
Unfortunately, as he well knew, the newspaper articles were for the most part accurate. He had indeed been visited in Albany by a national committeeman from Wisconsin who told him that most of the Western friends of McKinley thought his name would strengthen the ticket, and that he would be nominated substantially without opposition if he agreed to run. The committeeman added that he would be extremely lucky to get through 1900 without alienating either the organization men or the independents forever, and that it would be tempting providence to try for two terms. It was also true that there was a growing vice presidential boom for the governor in Washington. Lodge had intensified his efforts to swing the nomination for Roosevelt, to the extent of going to the White House and asking McKinley point blank for the chairmanship of the convention. The president, taken aback, agreed at once. Lodge also got the impression that McKinley was perfectly content to have Roosevelt on the ticket. But then McKinley also seemed to be perfectly content with everything. Lodge's own correspondence with Roosevelt dangled a tempting bait, conditional on his acceptance of the nomination. The chance to become the first Governor General of the Philippines. He informed his friend, with what truth one cannot tell, that McKinley would be favorable to the appointment once the current native insurrection against U.S. rule was crushed. That might take another year or two, during which time Roosevelt, as vice president, would remain close to McKinley's elbow and be available for instant nomination whenever the insurgent general, Emilio Aguinaldo, surrendered. It so happened that no job, short of the presidency itself, so appealed to Roosevelt. Convinced as he might be that Cuba deserved its freedom from Spanish rule, he was equally convinced that the Philippines needed the benison of an American colonial administration.
"I feel sure that we can ultimately help our brethren so far forward on the path of self-government and orderly liberty that that beautiful archipelago shall become a center of civilization for all Eastern Asia and the islands round about."
However, this bright vision was, he sensed, altogether too remote to pursue by the devious route Lodge recommended. Pressed to give his friend a decision on the vice presidency, he wrote on 2 February, "With the utmost reluctance, I have come to a conclusion that is against your judgment." Then, with recourse to his favorite metaphor, "American politics are kaleidoscopic, and long before the next 5 years are out, the kaleidoscope is certain to have been many times shaken and some new men to have turned up. Now, the thing to decide at the moment is whether I shall try for the governorship again or accept the vice presidency if offered. I have been pretty successful as governor. There is ample work left for me to do in another term, work that will need all of my energy and capacity. In short, work well worth any man's doing. But in the vice presidency, I could do nothing. I am a comparatively young man yet, and I like to work. I do not like to be a figurehead. It would not entertain me to preside in the Senate. I could not do anything. And yet I would be seeing continually things I would like to do. Finally, the personal element comes in. Though I am a little better off than the Sun correspondent believes, I have not sufficient means to run the social side of the vice presidency as it ought to be run. I should have to live very simply, and would be always in the position of poor man at a frolic. So, old man, I am going to declare decisively that I want to be governor and do not want to be vice president."
Lodge's reaction to this flat refusal was ambiguous. While Senator Platt proved deaf to Roosevelt's heavy hint, "Now I should like to be governor for another term." On 3 February, Roosevelt discovered why. The big insurance companies of New York, furious over his ouster of Payne, had, to a man, joined the franchise corporations already prevailing upon Platt to kick the governor upstairs. This represented a combined lobbying power of approximately $1 billion. After a less-than-reverent meeting in the Amen Corner on 10 February, during which Platt cynically inquired what Roosevelt would do if the convention nominated him by unanimous vote, "I would not accept," the governor shot back. Roosevelt made the first public statement of his views 2 days later. It was both a rejection of the vice presidential nomination and a plea for renomination as governor. "And I am happy to say," he concluded, to the puzzlement of many reporters, "that Senator Platt cordially acquiesces in my views in the matter." If by that he meant the dry statement of support which Platt issued a little later, the governor showed surprising ignorance of the fine art of political equivocation. The story of the next 2 months, culminating in the governor's election as a delegate at large to Philadelphia on 17 April, is best expressed in the incomparable image of Thomas Collier Platt.
"Roosevelt might as well stand under Niagara Falls and try to spit water back as to stop his nomination by this convention."
President McKinley remained studiously neutral amidst the frantic lobbying for Roosevelt against such minor candidates as Cornelius Bliss, Timothy Woodruff, and John D. Long. Mark Hanna soon emerged as the governor's principal opponent in Washington, swearing and thumping dramatically on his desk whenever the name Roosevelt was mentioned. Friends were puzzled by the violence of Hanna's antipathy. There was something almost of terror in it. The national chairman still clung to his massive administrative and patronage powers, augmented by the dignity of his Senate seat, but age and ill health were making him increasingly unstable. Fits of roaring, blind anger alternated with childlike querulousness. The famous warmth seemed to have faded along with the light in his eyes. The truth was that Hanna was no longer sure of his influence on McKinley. His adoration for the podgy little president was such that the slightest hint of coolness depressed him. Recently, McKinley had found it necessary to withdraw somewhat from Hanna, who had a habit of trying to run the White House, and he would not say whether or not he would allow him to remain national chairman through the convention. Hanna promptly suffered a heart attack. Roosevelt was neither involved nor particularly interested in the McKinley-Hanna relationship. But Nicholas Murray Butler's news that neither man appeared to favor him for the vice presidency left him oddly chagrined. He thought the office unsuitable for himself, but did not like to have eminent persons think him unsuitable for the office. Another unsettling influence was the flinty resolution of his best friend to nominate him at Philadelphia, whether he liked it or not.
"The qualities that make Cabot invaluable as a public servant also make him quite unchangeable when he has determined that a certain course is right," Roosevelt complained to Bammy. "There is no possible use in trying to make him see the affair as I look at it, because our points of view are different. He regards me as a man with a political career."
During the last week of April, the governor's intransigence toward the nomination began to show subtle signs of change.
"By the way," he wrote suddenly to Lodge, "I did not say on February 12 that I would not under any circumstances accept the vice presidency."
Lodge must have been puzzled by this remark, for Roosevelt's exact words to the press had been, "It is proper for me to state that under no circumstances could I or would I accept the nomination for the vice presidency." Then, on 26 April, he delivered himself of another public statement, which was markedly looser.
"I would rather be in private life than be vice president. I believe I can be of more service to my country as governor of the state of New York."
He explained somewhat shamefacedly to Paul Dana of the Sun that he must leave certain avenues open simply because if it were vital for me to help the ticket by going in, I would feel that the situation was changed. Dana's own opinion was, "If they want you, you had better take it." By the end of the legislative session on 8 May, the governor was having such doubts he decided to visit Washington and check the vice presidential opinions of various eminent men in the Capitol. These dignitaries included Senators Foraker and Chandler, Secretaries Root and Long, and President McKinley himself, who gave a dinner in Roosevelt's honor on 11 May. Accounts vary as to what Roosevelt was told and what he said in reply. Foraker remembered him asking for help in suppressing the nomination at Philadelphia, then returning next day to complain furiously that McKinley and his aides did not want him to run.
"There is no reason why they should not want me, and I will not allow them to discredit me. If the convention wants me, I shall accept."
On the other hand, John D. Long, whom Roosevelt discovered typically taking a post-prandial stroll, got the impression that the governor of New York wished to remain in Albany. This may well have been wishful thinking, because Long badly wanted the nomination himself. By far the best account of Roosevelt's visit was written by Secretary of State John Hay to Joseph Buckland Bishop after Roosevelt had returned north.
"Teddy has been here. Have you heard of it? It was more fun than a goat. He came down with a somber resolution thrown on his strenuous brow to let McKinley and Hanna know, once and for all, that he would not be vice president, and found to his stupefaction that nobody in Washington except Platt had ever dreamed of such a thing. He did not even have a chance to launch his nolo episcopari at the major, McKinley. That statesman said he did not want him on the ticket, that he would be far more valuable in New York. And Root said, with his frank and murderous smile, 'Of course not. You're not fit for it.' And so he went back quite eased in his mind, but considerably bruised in his amour propre." Theodore Roosevelt's behavior at the Republican National Convention in June 1900, while entirely characteristic, was so puzzling as to defy logical analysis. Notwithstanding his genuine repugnance for the vice presidency, it is impossible to read his private letters and not feel it palpably, he seems to have courted the nomination from the moment he stepped off the train in Philadelphia on Saturday the 15th. His very presence at the convention was a positive gesture. It would have been easy for him, as governor, to prevent his nomination as a delegate at large 2 months before. Lodge had mockingly warned him that to accept delegation was to be nominated. But he had responded that, "I would be looked upon as rather a coward if I didn't go." By this reasoning, mere token attendance would have shown courage enough. Roosevelt could have then sought to deflate his boom by remaining as inconspicuous as possible in order to avoid attracting the attention of delegates and reporters. But he chose to arrive in town wearing a large, soft, black, wide-rimmed hat, which stood out among Philadelphia's countless straw boaters like a tent in a wheat field. His fellow delegates at large, Senator Platt, Chairman Odell, and Chauncey Depew, noted with amusement how en route to the Hotel Walton, he coveted the recognition of the crowd and kept up a running conversation with the inevitable train of reporters. Nicholas Murray Butler, who had been sent ahead with express orders to nip any draft Roosevelt movement in the bud, remembered the galvanic effect of his entrance into the Walton's main lobby. He walked in with his quick, nervous stride, and at once the crowd waked up. T.R.'s name was on every lip
and the question as to whether or not he should be forced to take the vice presidency pushed every other question into the background. All Saturday evening the delegations kept coming, and it was perfectly evident to me on Sunday morning that only the most drastic steps would prevent T.R.'s nomination. The run began with the Kansas delegation, who had been reading William Allen White editorials for a year and were anxious for the honor of being first to declare in Roosevelt's favor. But the governor